Hopefully it will be entertaining and informative to everyone. So black holes are perhaps the most profoundly mysterious objects in physics. For example, we believe that the fundamental structure of space and time itself probably breaks down in the center of a black hole. Or to give you another example for why I say that, Hawking has suggested that a consistent treatment of black holes and their evaporation leads to a breakdown of quantum mechanics. Indeed, he has proposed that the corresponding evolution is fundamentally non-unitary and evolves pure states into mixed, well, into density matrices describing mixed states at the fundamental level rather than unitary evolution as we're used to in quantum mechanics. Now, many workers don't believe that statement. Many workers in the field, but we do lack a clear picture of what does happen. Each of the possible alternatives to try to evade Hawking's arguments seem to be problematic. And that has led to the formulation of what has been called the black hole information paradox. Basically, as I say, it's hard to see how to reconcile the various concepts that go into that, the notion that black holes should Hawking radiate and so on. And the favored explanation at this point is that somehow, mysteriously, locality breaks down in the context of black holes and allows information to come out of a black hole. So there are a number of intriguing puzzles and ideas in the subject of black hole physics, and really it serves as a great testing ground for understanding the quantum mechanics of gravity. What I'd like to do today is discuss a seemingly preposterous but yet possible scenario that it could be possible to experimentally explore these ideas by actually producing black holes and watching them evaporate. Okay, so first of all, why is that seemingly preposterous? Let's talk a little bit about what you would do to make black holes and do some quick estimates. So let's imagine that we think about scattering particles off of one another in an accelerator, say electrons and positrons, just to keep things simple, in an attempt to make a black hole. Well, what is a black hole? We can go back to the original discussion of Laplace, and remember that a black hole is an object whose escape velocity exceeds the velocity of light. So if we have these particles, each with energy, say, E over 2, and we manage to focus them into some small region, then we can ask what the escape velocity is at a given radius from the center of that region. And the escape velocity, of course, is, well, roughly given by the Newtonian law. So we have Newton's gravitational constant. Then the mass, or E over c squared, the total energy over c squared, and then divided by the radius at which we're measuring the velocity. Now, if we demand that that escape velocity be equal to the speed of light, then that determines the radius at which a horizon or black hole will form. Okay, so if we can get energetic particles that close together, we can imagine forming a black hole. If we can get them within this characteristic radius, given the energy. But there's another thing we need to bear in mind, and that is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics tells us that these particles aren't really point particles, in a sense, but they're quantum mechanical waves. And so they will be kind of smeared out in space. And in order to really think of them as being focused into a region of a given size, that region has to be larger than their wavelength. So that is to say, actually, is this too low to write? Okay, keep it up. Okay, that is to say, the wavelength corresponding to one of these particles in the relativistic limit is h bar c over the energy, and that should be less than the horizon radius in order to really say that you're forming a black hole. So when you combine this constraint together with this equation, you get a statement that the energy has to be above a certain value in order to actually form a black hole. That value is a number written in terms of the fundamental constants of nature, Planck's constant, the speed of light, and gravitational constant. And it comes out to be, in units that we usually use in particle physics, 10 to the 19 GeV. So that's the so-called Planck energy. I'll work in the rest of the talk in units in which h bar and c are equal to 1. So this also I can, in those in units where c equals 1, I can think of as corresponding to a mass, the four-dimensional Planck mass. So that's an enormously high energy. We're used to exploring energies around a TeV, 10 to the 3 GeV, or even a little less so far, in current accelerators. And so that seems completely inaccessible and out of reach. But what I'll talk about today is a new idea that people have been thinking about a lot. And that new idea goes by the name of TeV scale gravity. And that offers the possibility of making this kind of process accessible. I should mention, and as you'll see later in the talk, the ideas of string theory play a central role in at least one way of approaching TeV scale gravity. Okay, so in outline, in my talk, I'm first going to talk about the mechanism for, in effect, lowering the Planck scale down to a reasonable energy involving large extra dimensions. Then I'll talk about some of the basic ideas of string theory and brains that allows, or that are helpful in formulating such a scenario. I'll then talk about black holes in the context of these scenarios, known as brain world scenarios. Following that, we'll turn to the question of producing black holes at accelerators, what rate that would take place at. And then talk about how you would see black holes through their decays. And then finally, a very interesting possibility that black holes could be produced in cosmic ray events. And finally, some comments on the future of high energy physics, if such a scenario is true. Here are a few references, and the most accessible of these are some lectures I wrote up for, well, from this summer's SNOMASS 2001 conference. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about how you could possibly evade the need to get all the way up to 10 to the 19th GeV. And this comes about through the possibility that space could have extra dimensions. Everyone here is probably familiar with the basic Kaluza-Klein scenario. We imagine that space has d, or actually space-time, has d dimensions, and that those dimensions are such that, say, four of them are non-compact, the ones that we see, and then d minus four of them are curled up on some kind of compact manifold, which I'm oversimplifying, drawing as a circle. Okay, so these are the d minus 4 dimensions and the 4 that we see. And so if you imagine that this cylinder is infinitely long and you stare at it from very far away, of course it looks one-dimensional, or really if you include all four dimensions, it looks four-dimensional. So at distances large as compared to the radius of the cylinder, we have, well, our effectively four-dimensional reality. But of course, if you look at processes that take place at distances short as compared to the radius of the cylinder, then this looks like really d dimensions. You can see all of the space-time dimensions. Now, one of the things that we'll be, of course, most interested in is discussing the properties of gravity in such a configuration. And so let's think about what happens when you have, say, a point mass of, say, mass m, and, say, another test mass, mass little m, and let's ask about what the force is between those two objects. Well, if they're very far away, as compared to the size of the cylinder, then everything looks like it's effectively four-dimensional. And of course, the force law is the familiar Newton's force law in four space-time dimensions with a 1 over r squared dependence. But of course, if you allow these two masses to become close, very close together, much closer together than this characteristic radius, then you see all of the dimensions of space and time. And so the corresponding force law changes. It becomes GMM over r to the d minus 2, the obvious higher dimensional generalization of the 1 over r squared falloff. In fact, one of the ways of understanding this is by looking at the, one of the ways of explaining this falloff is by looking at the behavior of field lines. Very close to this mass, the field lines are fanning out in all of the d minus 1 spatial dimensions, and so you get a 1 over r to the d minus 2 falloff of the force. But then when you go out at longer distances, they start getting effectively confined by the finite size of the cylinder, and so you get a fall off in the density of field lines that goes like 1 over r squared. Now, of course, there should be a nice matching between these two behaviors as you gradually move these two masses further and further apart. At a radius of order the size of the cylinder, these force formula must agree. Okay, so at, these should be equal at r equals r, the radius of the cylinder. And so we just set these two expressions equal to one another and learn that the four-dimensional apparent Newton's constant that we see times the radius of the compact dimensions should be, should be related to the fundamental Newton's constant by that formula that depends on effectively the volume of the extra dimensions. Or, in other words, written in terms of this Planck mass that we talked about a moment ago, m4 squared, the four-dimensional Planck mass squared, should be of order the fundamental Planck mass, which I'll call m sub p, that's the fundamental d-dimensional Planck mass, it should be related to that to the d minus 2 power times r to the d minus 4. Again, this factor is essentially the volume of the extra dimensions.
Is it obvious that there is just a single radius r?
No. So I'm just keeping things really simple. In general, the expression that enters there is actually the integrated volume. So you could have something highly curved that, and so on. And actually, what enters there, in more generality, you can have a different kind of compactification where a slightly different expression, not even the volume, enters there. I'll mention that later. So actually, everyone should feel free to ask questions as they come up. Okay, so let's stare at this relationship between the four-dimensional Planck mass and the d-dimensional Planck mass. And we see that there are at least two obvious possibilities that we can imagine for how we get out the four-dimensional Planck mass that we see. The first is the conventional scenario that has been widely explored in string theory, thought about a lot over the years, and that is that the fundamental Planck mass and the inverse size of the extra dimensions are both of order the four-dimensional Planck mass, which is, again, around 10 to the 19 GeV. And this means that the extra dimensions are extremely tiny, perhaps around roughly 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. We aren't going to see them anytime soon. But when you stare at this formula a bit longer, you realize that there's a lot of latitude to play around with the radius. And for example, you can imagine another scenario, which is the TV scale gravity scenario. If r, the radius, is very large as compared to the Planck scale in the higher dimensions, then apparent Planck mass is very large as compared to the fundamental Planck mass. Okay, so there's a lot of latitude here, but then the next obvious question is, well, how big should the fundamental Planck mass be? If it's not 10 to the 19th GeV, what should it be? Well, so you think about that and you realize that in physics, in theoretical physics today, there are really two centrally important energy or mass scales that are believed to play a very fundamental role in physics. One is the Planck mass, and the other is the weak scale of order a TeV. Well, 300 GeV, or, you know, it's up to how you define it. But it's roughly around a TeV. And one of the outstanding problems in theoretical physics today is the so-called hierarchy problem. And that is to explain from first principles this very small ratio that we see when we take the ratio of the fundamental, or sorry, the ratio of the weak scale to the apparent Planck scale, that ratio being of order 10 to the minus 16, a very tiny number. And the question is how to explain that tiny number. That's the hierarchy problem. Now, well, so if we look at it, what is another logical choice for the fundamental Planck mass? Well, it turns out that, this actually suggests that a logical choice is that the Planck mass is of order a TeV, and for other reasons, that is a nice choice, which I don't have time to explain the details of, but that's certainly a reasonable logical possibility, and it's one that has been pursued quite extensively in the hopes of really solving the hierarchy problem and explaining this tiny ratio. Okay, so what does that mean in terms of this radius, or the size of the extra dimensions? Well, depends on how many extra dimensions there are. If there are two extra dimensions, then the radius should be roughly of order millimeters or fractions of millimeters, it turns out. Yes?
D is the total number.
But if the total number of dimensions is 10, as we favor in string theory, then this radius should be perhaps around 10 Fermi or so. So quite tiny on ordinary scales, but quite large as compared to the scales we've measured. Yeah?
I'm not a string theorist whatsoever.
Good.
Isn't it that you introduce extra dimensions to get rid of this notion of point particles? Here you give an argument that is based on point.
Yeah.
That surprised me.
Okay, we'll come back to that. We'll get rid of point particles in a moment. But for the time being, we're going to think of particles as being point-like, and
it's
even in higher dimensions. And in fact, they're, you know, as long as the dimensions are large as compared to the string scale, I'll come to that in a second, then you can think of them as being point-like. Okay, so the idea is, again, that you can get a large apparent Planck mass from a fundamental Planck mass that is much smaller, 1 TeV, by having large extra dimensions. There's another scenario, which I won't go into the mechanics of, which involves more sort of strongly curved extra dimensions, so-called warp compactifications, that actually generalizes this, and there's been a lot of investigation of those in string theory as well, with similar results in a lot of respects. Okay, so this sounds like a lot of fun, but it also sounds absolutely nuts, because here I'm saying that there are extra dimensions of space at the, say, 10 Fermi scale, at the least, and we know that the forces that we've well studied, electromagnetism, the weak force, quantum chromodynamics, have all been tested to of order, what, something like 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, the distance corresponding to of order, say, 100 GeV or so. And they have been found to have their feet firmly grounded in four-dimensional space-time. None of this funny extra-dimensional stuff. So it looks like this idea is a non-starter right at the beginning. But here's where string theory comes in. So let me review a few basic ideas of string theory. Okay, so let's consider a simple object, for example, a hydrogen atom. We know that a hydrogen atom consists of a proton and then an electron that follows a trajectory around it. And the basic idea of string theory is that that electron, if you magnify it sufficiently, is not a point-like particle as it first appears, but really is a little tiny one-dimensional filamentary object called a string. The size here is known as the string scale, okay? And that is expected to be very roughly something like the Planck length, although there can be a somewhat significant difference. Okay, likewise, if you think about the proton, well, we know that the proton is composite. It has quarks inside of it. But if you look at the quarks and magnify them, they also should be described as being strings at very short distances. So again, answering this question earlier, it's at distances long as compared to this distance that I really can think of these things as being point-like. And the idea is that the distances over here that we're talking about are long as compared to the characteristic string length. Okay, so that's how string theory describes the basic particles of nature, all of them. Let's think about interactions. So for example, we know that what binds the hydrogen atom together is electromagnetism. And in traditional particle descriptions, electromagnetism can be thought of as a process by which, say, an electron comes along and exchanges a photon with a quark, one of the quarks in the nucleus, and that's how they're bound together. And so let's take this interaction here and magnify it by the same factor, whatever it is, and ask what that looks like in string terms. In string terms, the electron is, well, this one-dimensional object, so it propagates along in time. And then the photon splitting off corresponds to another kind of string in a different state of motion splitting off. And then the photon in the new momentum state is yet another string. So these interactions are described in terms of splitting or joining of fundamental strings. And this also illustrates this point that all of the particles of nature can be thought of as being different states of motion of the fundamental string. So states of motion of the string correspond to different particles. Okay, so for example, the up quark, the down quark, the electron, the neutrino, and then the other generations of matter, the photon, the W plus and minus, and the Z, and the gluons, the mediators of the strong force, all are just different states of motion of the string. Okay, but I've left something out, and that is the force that we are most interested in, and that's gravity. So, as we know, there will be an interaction between the electron and the quarks in the nucleus, mediated by the gravitational force as well. It's much tinier at ordinary distances. That interaction comes from exchange of a graviton. So what does that picture look like when you magnify it? Well, okay, so here we have our incoming string with n's corresponding to an electron. And then what can happen is we can have a string that is a closed string state branch off from our electron string, and then you can be left with an open string in a different state, say, well, an electron in a different momentum state. And so our picture is that the emission of a graviton corresponds to emission of a closed string, a string without ends. And all of the fundamental interactions, therefore, are described just by string splitting and joining. Now, of course, I've given one particular picture of how string theory might realize the world with open strings corresponding to matter, and that will be important for what I'm about to say. There are other alternative pictures where matter as well as gravitons are described by closed strings. So there are different possibilities, and I'm focusing on one. Okay, now a discovery that helped ignite a lot of the recent activity in string theory was made right here in Santa Barbara by Joe Polchinski, and that's the notion of D-brains. So these open strings have ends, and you might think that the ends can freely move around in space, but it's also possible that you can have objects in the theory, generalizations of membranes, that the ends of the string get stuck to, so that the ends cannot move transversely to the so-called D-brain, D standing for Dirichlet, but they can move along the D-brain. Okay, so these are actually present in generic string compactifications, generic situations where you have extra dimensions, and in fact, their existence is implied by the various dualities that you may have heard referred to in string theory. And these D-brains form a made-to-order solution to a problem of reconciling this TV scale gravity picture with the observation that matter that we see only moves in four dimensions, because you can imagine that here again is our picture of all of the dimensions of space and time. And you can imagine that, for example, we might be interested in a string configuration where there's a D-brain, for example, a 3-brain, in those extra dimensions, and that the matter that we see, the photons and electrons and so on, are all confined to this 3-brain in the extra dimensions, so effectively are stuck in a 3-dimensional space. And on the other hand, as I said, gravity is transmitted by strings that are closed. Therefore, gravitons, well, they don't have ends to get stuck, so to speak. Gravitons can propagate in the extra dimensions. So this is a way of explaining why electromagnetism seems 4-dimensional, whereas gravity might be really D-dimensional. Okay. So the exploration of such scenarios has been quite active recently. And as I mentioned, there are generalizations involving so-called warped compactifications and so on. Okay, so now let's turn to our question at hand, that of making black holes. So black holes on brain worlds. So we're going to imagine that, that again, we live on a 3-brain. This is just a different picture of a 3-brain. And that the electrons are described by states that move on this 3-brain, and we want to scatter two electrons and make a black hole. Now, of course, if we do that, actually move that back, the black hole will be, since it's a gravitational object, it will be an object that lives up in the full D-dimensional spacetime. It will extend off of the brain. And the first thing we'd like to do is learn about some of the properties of those black holes. Now, of course, this is a very complicated gravitational solution for two reasons. The first is that these brains have a mass density, and so those deform the gravitational field of the black hole. And also, the extra dimensions can be curved, and they have a finite size, and that will change the structure of the black hole. But I'm going to make two approximations. The first is to suppose that the radius of the black hole is small as compared to the size of the extra dimensions, r. Remember, that was kind of big, so that seems reasonable. The second approximation I'm going to make is that the mass of the black hole is large as compared to the mass per unit area or volume of the brain or the tension. And those two approximations mean that, in effect, we can study to zeroth order in those approximations the black holes and think of them as being black holes simply in d-dimensional flat space. We're ignoring the effects of the extra dimension, of the curvature of the extra dimensions and the finite size, and ignoring the effects of the brain. Okay, so when can we make such a black hole? At what energy do we have to scatter particles? Well, the answer to that we've discussed at the very beginning. We're going to be able to, or we expect to be able to make such black holes when the energy exceeds the Planck mass. And just to be safe, let's put a little margin in there. Let's say it has to be bigger than, say, 5 times the Planck mass.
Did you say the black hole mass is much bigger than the tension? Is that right?
Yes.
So do you have to worry about the effect of the
What'll happen is sort of the brain will go into the black hole, and solutions like that have been studied, for example, with cosmic strings going into black holes and so on. So
write down classical solutions.
Yes. Yeah. So. Okay. So actually, I should have said before I talked about black holes on brain worlds, this kind of scenario is known as a brain world scenario. And I am bearing in mind that now, in such a brain world scenario, the Planck mass can be as low as, say, a TeV or so. Okay, so we'll make black holes up around energy something like that.
So these are not quite Schwarzschild solutions. They're solutions of the high dimensional Einstein.
They're the d-dimensional generalization of Schwarzschild, or actually
curve.
Do they
reduce to Schwarzschild in some limit? Or?
Well, if you assume that they have no spin, then they're literally d-dimensional Schwarzschild. They don't sort of reduce to four-dimensional Schwarzschild, except when they're much bigger than the extra dimensions, and then you're looking at a slightly different kind of solution. It's a black string in the extra dimensions. Okay, so so those are the things we have in mind. Just to mention some of their properties. So, of course, they have a radius that you can estimate by the calculation we started out with. You've got to look at the d-dimensional version of that calculation. So you find that the radius goes like their mass to the 1 over d minus 3 power. And then, as Hawking has discovered, Hawking has argued that they radiate. They have a Hawking temperature. And that Hawking temperature goes like 1 over the horizon radius. And then these also correspondingly have an entropy, which goes like, well, in four dimensions, the horizon area, and the obvious generalization of that is the horizon radius to the d minus 2 power. And then there are numerical and dimensional constants in these formulas that I've left out. And indeed, if we want to think of these as thermodynamic objects, for example, if we calculate the entropy for the 5 Planck mass black hole, this is bigger than about 25 for the 5 Planck mass black hole, at least in 10 dimensions. And so that is one criterion for when you want the entropy to be large if you really want to describe these things as being approximately thermodynamic or semi-classical objects. So this is just a rough guideline for for when you're really talking about black holes as opposed to something more complicated. Okay, so those are the basic features of these black holes on brain worlds. Now let's turn to their production at accelerators. Okay, now first of all we should ask what's a reasonable assumption about the value of the Planck mass? And it turns out that there are experimental bounds that the Planck mass, at least in the conventions that I've chosen, has to be bigger than about 800 GeV. That's based on the fact that we don't see processes where you effectively have missing energy because you, say, scatter two electrons or two protons and have a graviton go off into the extra dimensions. So there's a bound, something like that. So actually, it is reasonable to assume, a little bit on the optimistic side, that the Planck mass could be around a TeV.
Why does graviton go? Because you can constrain all the other things to stay on the brain.
Yeah, all the electrons, all the gauge fields.
Why? That's because of this idea that the ends of the strings are stuck to the brain.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. Well, because they're D brains, and you know, as Joe told us, you know, this is the whole theory of D brains is such that that strings are stuck to them. So, okay. So we'd like to explore creation of objects up around 5 TeV or so. Now, the current energy frontier is at proton-proton machines, and indeed, if we're going to make things that weigh 5 TeV, then we've got to focus on the next machine, or the first machine that'll reach this region, which is the Large Hadron Collider, presently under construction at CERN. So in the Large Hadron Collider, one is not colliding electrons, one is colliding protons. And as we said earlier, protons are not fundamental objects. They're made out of smaller things, quarks. Really at high energies, both quarks and gluons. So you should think of a proton as a composite object made out of a bunch of smaller objects. And what you're interested in is, say, scattering the protons, but really scattering the smaller objects, often called partons, and imagining that two of those partons collide to form a black hole. And you'd like to compute the rate that this would happen, for example, at LHC. And two things come into this rate calculation. The first is basically the distribution of partons as a function of momentum, the fraction of partons with a given momentum. And the second thing, so that's a known thing, or at least estimated. And the second thing that comes into this is the rate for two partons, or the cross-section for two partons to form a black hole. That's the thing that a priori you don't know. But again, you can estimate it based on the kind of geometrical reasoning about the formation of a horizon that we started out with.
Is there a substantial difference between partons and quarks?
Well, partons can also be gluons. There's lots of junk in a proton. I see. Okay. All right. So the question is, at what rate do partons form black holes? And so you have to look at the density of partons, which basically comes into this distribution, and ask yourself the question, how close do two partons have to come in order to form a black hole? So we have parton I and parton J colliding at an impact parameter B. And the question is, when do those form a black hole? And the answer is they should form a black hole if the impact parameter is less than about the horizon radius, which depends on the energy of the two partons. Okay, so that tells us that the so-called cross-section goes like pi times that horizon radius squared, roughly. This is a rough estimate. So now if we assume that the Planck mass is of order 1 TeV, and we think about what will happen at LHC, well, at LHC, we're colliding protons at a center of mass energy, which is 14 TeV. And you can plug this estimate for the parton cross-section into the, into a formula together with the distribution of partons and these parameters, and you find something rather remarkable. The rate, according to this estimate, at which black holes would be produced at LHC is, if black holes are can honestly be produced starting at 5 Planck masses, the rate is about 1 per second, which is quite amazing. In fact, anything that can be produced at a given accelerator at the rate of 1 per second qualifies that accelerator to be called a factory of that object. So if under these assumptions, LHC could be a black hole factory. Questions.
How does the rate scale with your assumption about what the Planck mass is?
Let me see. Well, you can figure it out pretty easily from that. It's what's that? Exercise for the reader. It's a power.
I'm asking
it's a power.
The one TeV is, I mean, as we know, it's really extremely optimistic.
Yes. Well, it's optimistic. I don't know if I'd say extremely optimistic, but it's optimistic. Yes.
I mean, you need two extra dimensions to have that, which, for example...
No. Actually, it does, in two large extra dimensions, it should be even higher, it turns out, because there are constraints that the radii... There are constraints, say, from the supernova bounds and so on, that tells you you have to push... Well, for example, a 10-dimensional string model with the extra dimensions of size of order 10 Fermi. That would do. Okay? And again, the bounds one finds from these missing energy constraints are around 800. So, there was another question.
Is the assumption that all the extra dimensions are on?
For the moment, yeah. They're larger than the Planck scale by some factor.
Are you assuming here that the cross section is made up of black hole production and it's not producing other junk as well?
Well, yeah, I'm assuming that once these things get to within the inside the horizon, then you're forced to form a black hole. And that's certainly what happens classically. Once you, there's a long story which I could tell you more about, where one looks at the, under what circumstances one actually forms a black hole. And basically, if you get these things close enough together, you form a classical horizon. You've got a black hole.
It's a black hole.
Yeah, it can't go away classically. It has to Hawking radiate. Yeah?
If you consider nucleus-nucleus collision at LHC, you have slightly lower energy...
Nucleus-nucleus?
At LHC.
Yeah, okay.
You have slightly lower energy by factor three, but you have a lot more partons.
Yeah.
Does that increase your
rate? I don't know what the... I don't know. It's obviously a trade-off of two things, and I'm not sure what wins.
You partons by factor 200 more.
Yeah, that's, but obviously you're far further off on the tail of the parton distribution function. So I'm not sure. Okay, so another possibility you might say, maybe you're a little optimistic with this 5 Planck masses. Maybe you really only make black holes at 10. So if you say that black holes to be talked about have to be that size, 10 Planck masses. Then you'd still have about 3 per day. Okay? So it's still a respectable rate.
What is the lifetime of these?
It's of order the... for the tiniest ones, it's of order the TeV timescale. Okay, so TeV converted into seconds. It's 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, and so 10 to the minus 27 seconds. And then it scales with the power of the mass. So it's pretty tiny.
Steve, what about angular momentum?
Okay, that leads into my next part of my discussion. that, actually, I'll put it over here, is the question of black hole decays. So if you produce black holes in accelerators, the obvious question is, can you see them? What would the decays of a black hole look like? Now, I've slightly oversimplified things by saying that these horizons are spherical. In fact, when you collide two things with a finite impact parameter, you're initially going to form a black hole that is rather asymmetrical. And the first thing that will happen is it will classically radiate gauge and gravitational radiation, so it can settle down into a configuration that corresponds to a stationary black hole, in other words, a black hole with no hair. It will have a spin in general, and it will have a mass, but those are the only two parameters. Well, of course, there could be charge, but charge is not relevant. It's shed quite quickly in this discussion. So you end up with a hairless black hole, and for that reason, this process we refer to as balding. Okay. Yeah, the color, the charge, yeah, is, comes out on roughly similar timescales. So, how? It's an analog of the Schwinger process, basically. We know that electrically charged black holes aren't stable, and likewise for color-charged ones. Okay, so you can estimate how much energy you lose in this process, and it's of order 15% for an on-axis collision, zero impact parameter, and who knows what, well, you know, how that scales with the impact parameter. That's a very interesting question.
Why didn't it just turn back into the two protons that
make? Because they get stuck inside the horizon. And once once you're inside a horizon, there's no going back, at least classically. Okay, so.
You could be playing for the ventricle.
Well,
if you create a black hole, you increase the entropy enormously.
Well,
and so it's very unlikely for it to just reverse.
Well, the black hole has an entropy, but again, it can quantum mechanically decay. And well, yeah, I.
That's much larger. Well,
yeah. Well, okay, and they can decay, and this will come to that. But the point is that there's a small parameter, and that's the size of the black hole.
Talking about a coherent quantum mechanical evolution of the black hole.
Yeah, you're not fundamentally increasing the entropy of the black hole. It has an entropy.
Yeah.
But really what's going on is there is a small parameter that determines the decay time scale. And that parameter is a power of M Planck over the mass.
It's just not we should probably discuss this.
Yeah. Okay.
Not clear to me how that sigma, that cross section, is consistent with the subsequent soft decay picture.
Okay. Well, we should. Well, no, I don't think it does. But you have to be careful about tracking the number of states.
The problem is that when you're producing a black hole, it's this small. What you really have is an enormous number of states that you're producing,
it's related to this story.
Well, if it's not a simple resonance, then I don't believe that cross section.
This is supposedly a cross section to go into a large number of possible states. That's the only thing that would make sense.
Well, I would say it's a superposition of a large number of states, rather, because it is.
What
you still have
superposition.
Well, okay, it is a single state.
It's again, okay. Not a single state. You just said it has enormous entropy. What does that mean?
Well, okay. Okay, one is not fundamentally increasing the entropy in these processes. Okay.
And so the object you're talking about is not a particle.
Yes, that's also true. So, well, yeah, well.
If I can include the cross-section.
I think it's more like the following. If you have, say, a box, and you have two particles in a pure state in the corner of the box, a very simple looking state, then you allow those to evolve forward in time, you can have something that looks very thermal and looks like it has a very large entropy. And that, I think, is a nice analogy for explaining what we mean by the black hole entropy. So it has a large apparent entropy, although we believe that it's fundamentally still, if you started out with a pure state, it's still a pure state. So, and if you think about the state, the counting of states and so on, and how where that apparent entropy comes from, I think you resolve, or at least you have some prospect of resolving these various questions that have been raised with regard to time reversal and so on.
When you do the Bolden calculations, do you assume that you are just pouring a black hole with some set of quantum numbers and then letting it go?
When we do which calculations? Which calculations?
I mean, you're making a black hole which is
right.
Tearing, right? And you're letting it sit there.
Yes, yes, and so it classically radiates.
About it, you have this quantum waves coming through. Now, mm-hmm. If a black hole lives, you know, it has lots of quantum numbers still. Mm-hmm. And if it lives in a space where, you know, there's lots of waves around, then
yeah.
It'll stimulate emission.
Not
spontaneous emission, right? And that
yeah.
Stimulated emission basically may end up regenerating partons as they were there before.
Yeah, but the scales are different because this thing is really just formed from two partons, and effectively the other partons are off.
I'm saying about these two partons, right? I mean,
okay.
It's a quantum wave, part
yeah.
of which is.
Yeah. Well, I think that the description of this, there is. Well, you can use the semi-classical approximation. And the small parameter that justifies that, again, is M Planck over M, the size of the black hole. And so in that approximation, at least stimulated emission should be relatively small, but it will decay, and I'm coming to that. Yeah.
Can we agree that in a little very small black hole, when you get to
one Planck mass, yeah.
There's a question of how you go over to the limit of time symmetric scattering. But if you,
yeah,
if
absolutely.
You just imagine for the sake of argument that you had accelerators at a million TeV, and you put in a really large black hole, I think then, you know, we all agree that these things would decay.
But then the question is, what is the cross-section formula for reduction of the
flow? Oh, that is even better.
Yeah,
it exactly
just gets better and better. Yeah.
The Schwarzschild radius gets bigger and bigger as the energy goes up, and then it's really just a classical process of getting a lot of energy inside the Schwarzschild radius. So that approximation can improve.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Okay, so I.
Oh.
Well, that's an important question. Of course, it's related by a power of G string to the Planck size.
If
G string is of order 1, then the Planck size and the string size are about the same, so you do believe this.
No, but then I can't really think of these partons as point like objects. They're spread out strings which are.
Wait. Well, okay. No. Well, they're spread out on a scale of order the Planck size. Okay. They're spread out on a scale of order the Planck size, but we're looking at formation of black holes that's large as compared to the Planck size. Or the string size. Oh, okay. Yeah. Right, okay. That is an interesting question. Whether somehow formation of a large string could dominate over formation of a black hole. And it may be that those are really the same thing if you buy Susskind's pictures.
Not the same thing, but they would certainly make this argument invalid because you couldn't treat the quark like anymore within
that's
size.
Gets to be of order the size of the black hole. Yeah, I think that is an interesting question that is worth better understanding in string theory, certainly, the question. The string size for this energy actually grows faster than the black hole size. But the question is, you know, do you really dominantly make a large string, or when you take into account interactions, say, in your discussion of high energy scattering, are you really making some object that becomes more tightly bound and really behaves more like a black hole? And so that's a difficult problem, as you know.
That can sort of reduce this cross-section quite a bit. because some of the time, surely the string does look like a big extended object, not like a point cloud.
It could reduce it, or it could be that really they're just dual descriptions of the same thing. So that's an interesting question to really better understand the answer to. Okay, so continuing with decay. So you end up with a spinning black hole with a given mass. And classically, it can't decay any further, but of course, Hawking has told us that black holes decay quantum mechanically. And the first thing they do is they radiate quanta along the equatorial plane and lose their spin. So we call this the spin down phase. And so you end up with a black hole now with a mass m prime. And rough estimates tell you that delta m over m in this process, it's about 25%. So they lose their spin faster than they lose their mass.
This is assuming
they don't have
any trap magnetic field.
You mean like a magnetic monopole? Or?
No, like the black hole that was just reported in your
topic. Oh, let me see.
That
would modify. Yeah.
The magnetic field. These things are all formed out of quarks.
Yeah. The magnetic field should be, I think, small. It should be given in terms of the fundamental parameters. They're big. They're large as compared to the Planck size. So any of the charges on it are going to be of order 1, and these will be large as compared to that. The gravitational charge, as it were, is big as compared to any of the other charges.
Excuse me. I'm just wondering what you mean. I mean, black holes don't trap magnetic fields. If you're not talking about a charge, you're talking about a flux tube.
You can find
solutions with sort of black holes inside magnetic flux tubes, but the magnetic flux can be outside the black hole, and the black hole can evaporate, and it's not like a superconductor.
Yeah, I would think you'd actually lose the magnetic.
It's the source of energy that comes from.
In astrophysics, the magnetic field is created by an anchor to some external disk or something.
Oh, okay. So that would not be present.
Doesn't make sense. The magnetic line goes through the black hole and comes down.
Well, it could if you had somehow particles inside the black hole with charge rotating around, but those are going to be lost quickly.
I
would think those would be lost in this stage. Yeah, I would think the magnetic field, whatever it is lost in the stage where you lose the charge, which is quite early in the evolution.
But it's an important part of how the black hole loses energy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just a question of whether you could ignore the environment that this black hole is in.
Yeah.
Particle collision with a quark plasma.
Yeah.
And you have a black hole inside which couples.
But the scale of the quark plasma is the QCD scale, and the scale of the black hole is much tinier. So, so there's a separation of scales.
Black hole in an accretion disk around.
Yes. Well, actually, it can't. Well, it can't lose sort of most of its energy. Once you form a horizon, the horizon area cannot classically decrease.
That's just another way of losing angular momentum. Once the angular momentum is gone, it doesn't decrease.
So it can't get smaller that way, in the sense of its horizon decreasing. But it may lose some spin that way. And, well, interesting to think further about that. But certainly quantum mechanically they radiate, Hawking radiate, and lose all of their spin that way. And then subsequently you have just a Schwarzschild black hole, which will just undergo standard Hawking radiation, Hawking emission, until it reaches a stage where it's small enough that all of your calculations break down without a quantum theory of gravity. So here in this phase, you expect to lose about 75% roughly of the mass of the black hole. We call this the Schwarzschild phase. Yes?
How large does your black hole have to be so that you have a separation of time scales that really allows you to make the sequence?
Well, the small parameter again is m Planck over m.
Yeah.
And so the question is, Well,
talking about black holes, they could be as little as 3 black masses, or do you have to say it's 100?
Well, I think one guide is, again, the entropy, for example.
Yeah.
So 5 gives you an entropy of 25. 10 is even better because it's an entropy of something like 64, so somewhere in there. Yeah, certainly for the black holes near threshold, it may be quite hard to separate these phases. It's in really in the.
What is the time scale to spin down, for example? I know for evaporation, it's mass cubed.
Yeah, well, and again, that depends on the dimension.
Yeah.
That depends on the dimension. So, yeah, so there are powers of the mass, which I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's a power of the mass that enters. And so this time scale is basically the time scale set by the horizon radius for the classical emission, and then there are extra powers of the mass entering into this time scale. So it's factors that go like m over m Planck that separate the scales. So, you know, 5 is maybe pushing it a little, 10 is much better, and so on. So. Okay. So this we call the Schwarzschild phase, where it just undergoes standard Hawking radiation. And then finally, we're left with something. But as a Planck-size object, we can't any longer legitimately call that a black hole. It's some object you need quantum gravity to describe. And you would expect, in general, that to decay into, say, several quanta with energies of order the Planck energy. So this we call the Planck phase. Okay, so what would you see? Well, you see that most of the energy is radiated in the Schwarzschild phase. So you would first look for that radiation. That radiation is thermal, approximately thermal at a given time. And then you can find the full spectrum by integrating that over time. It's thermal with a characteristic energy given by the Hawking temperature, which is going to go range over something like, say, 100 GeV up to around a TeV through the evolution of the black hole. You'll radiate a fairly democratic distribution of particles. You radiate quark and lepton states with equal, and so on, with equal probability per species. And of course, you have a large number of total particles radiated given by the, roughly by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, say, of order at least 25. So can we see this kind of phenomena in detectors? Well, it should really stand out. You have a large number of particles radiated off in all directions, of order 25, with very high energies, comparatively speaking. And this kind of event looks very unusual. I don't know of any standard model or non-standard model physics that would do that. It would produce backgrounds that could compete with this. Also, ultimately, you may really be able to nail these things down by, for example, seeing this dipole-like pattern from the spin down. What? Yeah.
If you look isotropically at a TV, like the multiplicities are a few hundred, 200.
If you say if you scatter protons and you look for isotropic events?
Yeah, if you look anywhere except a rare event, you're going to see lots of crap. A lot of stuff on the forward, which you'll see as
well. Right.
You still have the rest of the partons carrying.
Yes.
70% of the energy going in the forward direction. So
It depends. We're pretty far out, say, on the tail of the parton distribution function, so it won't necessarily be that large of a fraction. Perhaps, okay.
It's a little
forward. Right.
A lot of forward stuff.
Right.
And
a spherical distribution. I didn't think that you get sort of typically, or very often spherical.
Jets.
Okay.
And then,
right.
You know, things which have lots of, each jet carries lots of particles. Well,
okay.
It's not clear to me here that you won't get a lot of jets because you're a parton that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Each parton.
That's right. Yeah. So you'll have
photons as well, and neutrinos.
Right. So, for example, you'd have maybe, I don't know, 20 jets, and then 5, say, hard electrons, and so on, and a few neutrinos.
Leptons,
Right.
Electron, neutrinos, gravitons, photons, none of which have jets. So the only thing that have jets are the quarks and the gluons.
Right, yes.
And, so you have four or five jets. What's atypical event about that?
Well, no, actually, you have the Hadron. Well, oh, okay. In terms of the number of
a lot of missing neutrinos and gravitons.
Well, no, the number of neutrinos and gravitons is relatively small. It turns out when you look at the what you see in the final state. Okay, it's and we've got rough estimates of the fraction. You see about five times as many hadrons as leptons in the end. You're wondering.
Is a jet one particle or 20?
Okay, well, at least the estimates we've given are for the final state particles after the. Sorry, for the primaries, excuse me. No, the number of jets is going to be. Well, okay, let me just give you one number, and that is, for example, the ratio of hadronic to leptonic activity is about 5-1. So that's the ratio of jets to of primary jets to leptons. Right. Yeah, again, well, there are more quark states, right? They're produced democratically. And so there are more quark states.
When you count 25, is that particles?
Yeah, that's primary particles. So it's you'd have
quartons and not final particles.
Because the time scales for say fragmentation into a jet are much longer than the time scale for decay of the black hole, right?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you count the entropy.
So this should be the number, I think, again of primary particles. So that would because again with the separation of scales you fragment at much longer times as the evaporation time. You fragment into jets. Okay, so it's.
There's a dynamical issue involved. If one quark produces 20 particles, you have to have some better way of calculating the entropy.
Well.
The entropy isn't increasing.
Well. Okay, I think, and put another way, I think you're in the asymptotically free regime here in the evaporation. Okay. You don't buy that. Okay, well, maybe we should discuss this further later. Yeah?
In the Schwarzschild field, don't you expect Baryon number violation?
Baryon number violation? That's a good question in TeV scale gravity in general, and I don't have an answer to that today, but you have to have some mechanism to prevent baryon number violation. For example, a local symmetry or a discrete gauge symmetry, for example. Yeah. So if you have a discrete gauge symmetry, I mean, that's a generic problem with TeV scale gravity scenarios. Well, okay, I didn't have time to talk about the various issues with TeV scale gravity scenarios. There are several issues that make them less likely than, say, supersymmetric guts. So they're plausible. You can, try to quiz people, for example, what odds they'd give to them, and they're less typically than supersymmetric guts, but it's certainly something that is a plausible scenario. Question? They shouldn't have such high velocity because typically they're made again out at the tail end of the parton distributions, and so they will carry some velocity, but most of the energy will go into actually making the black hole. Say if you're looking at trying to make them at LHC, so rather than into kinetic energy.
They're going to Brownian walk, basically, with velocities which are close to velocity of light. One particle is like 1/25 of the mass.
Yeah, okay, but the time scale is so tiny, they won't walk very far. Okay. 10 to the minus 17 centimeters times something. Okay, so I'm actually over time a bit. Let me just make a few more comments. One comment is that you should be careful about what you put on the preprint archive, because journalists these days go straight to the preprint archive and look for stories. And we were quite soon after posting our paper asked the question by a journalist, what happens if black holes don't decay? What happens if Hawking was wrong? And in the light of all the trouble that they had at RIC, this is a serious question in terms of, well, a sociological question. So now, of course, anyone who has studied Hawking's calculations believes that if they aren't right down to the last detail, they seem quite solid. And furthermore, in general, black holes are massive objects with no quantum numbers to stabilize them, and so on general quantum grounds, they should decay. But that sounds kind of abstract for a journalist, and especially when the fate of the Earth hangs in the balance. And so it's nice to have something more concrete, and that something more concrete is that cosmic rays hit the Earth's atmosphere with center of mass energies of order 400 TeV. They're believed to largely be... What's that? Yeah, that's around the maximum energy they've been seen at. And so black hole creation, well, and these are believed to be mainly, well, protons or nuclei. And so this should be a process that if you can make black holes at LHC that is going on all the time in the atmosphere. One would like to know at what rate these would be produced, and you can make some rough estimates. You could ask, can we actually see this process and discover black hole formation this way? If you look at the rate for protons, it's of order 100 per year over the entire surface of the Earth, however. So that's enough to assure journalists that this is going on all the time, so no worries, but it's not enough to see. The reason this is so small is because most of the proton events, you lose the protons through scattering from where the protons just interact via QCD events and turn into just other junk. And that leads to the possibility that you should consider other particles in the cosmic ray background. There's the possibility that some of those could be neutrinos. And there, this is something we're looking at, but let me just say that rough estimates suggest that we might be near the threshold where these kinds of events could be detected at presently operating or soon to be operating cosmic ray detectors. Okay, so let me just close by discussing one other interesting aspect of the future of high energy physics, if you believe these TeV scale gravity scenarios. And that is, we've been on this long, or this age-old quest to explore physics at ever shorter distances. And that is, of course, done by going to higher and higher energies because of the uncertainty principle. Now, it's widely believed that distances less than the Planck distance, in some sense, don't exist in a quantum mechanical theory of gravity. But one can imagine that there's some latitude there. Perhaps they, in some fundamental description, they do. And it's an interesting question to ask whether there could be some dynamics at shorter distances. And you might hope to eventually settle that experimentally. But if these scenarios about producing black holes are correct, then it turns out you cannot experimentally probe this regime. And the reason for that is that if you try to scatter two particles at very high energies as compared to the Planck scale, which is what you need to do to probe very short distances, before they scatter at those short distances, they're going to form a horizon. And so the short distance physics will be cloaked behind the horizon. You won't be able to see it because of the black hole. All you'll see is the Hawking radiation that comes off when this thing decays. So this suggests that really, if this is correct, this is the end of short distance physics. Now, I told one of our colleagues here, actually Claudio, about this, and he said, well, I don't like that. right? This is a dismal looking future. We're just if we're just producing black holes and nothing else, sounds kind of boring. But actually, this is not necessarily the end of high energy physics, because black holes could be used to explore the extra dimensions. Let me just give you quickly the idea for that. So let's imagine this is the shape of the extra dimensions, and we have, say, one radius scale here and then a bigger radius scale here. And I'm suppressing the dimensions that we see, so these are just the extra dimensions. And as we make black holes go to higher and higher energies, the black holes get bigger and bigger, and ultimately the black hole sizes can start getting as large as the characteristic sizes of the extra dimensions. When that happens, the rate for producing black holes, the cross-section estimate I gave you, the decay spectra, and so on, other properties all change. So ultimately, as you go to higher and higher energies, you are sensitive to the shape of the extra dimensions. For just tori, that might be rather boring, but if you have an interesting curved manifold that comprises the extra dimensions, or maybe other brain worlds out there, then you could actually hope to do a little exploring, so to speak, in the extra dimensions that way. So high energy physics should, in effect, the exploration of the, or should allow you to explore the geography of these extra dimensions. Okay, so I'm way over time. Let me just finish by summarizing the main points. So the fundamental Planck scale could be of order a TeV, and a lot of the ideas that come into that scenario are motivated by string theory. If so, we might start, or we should start making black holes at accelerators or in cosmic rays at potentially quite impressive rates. The decay signatures of these should be quite notable. This will close the frontier, we believe, of short distance physics, but it will represent opening of a new frontier, and that's exploration of the shape of the extra dimensions of space and time. So that's it.
You didn't prohibit Mayer number changes.
Yes.
What would be the proton decay time?
It would be way too fast. It'd be the TeV time scale or something like the TeV time scale or something to that effect. Or no, that's not quite right. But the higher dimension operators that lead to baryon number decay would be only suppressed by the TeV scale. So that's way too fast. So.
In all these scenarios, also since the string scale is at the order of the same magnitude
as the Planck scale,
there are a lot of other effects that are happening.
Yes.
Stringy effect.
Yeah, it'll be very exciting. Yeah. Right. Well, for example, one scenario you might imagine is that the string coupling is kind of small, in which case, before you start making black holes, you start making definitely excited strings, right. And that would be more fun than we could ever have imagined. Certainly, you'd see all these string resonances, and actually Peskin and collaborators, Perlstein and Cullen, have looked some at the signatures you would see from that. So yeah, TeV scale gravity, if it happens to be correct, will be the most amazing discovery in I don't know how long, a long time. So.
Okay, thanks, Steve.